Good morning and welcome to Waves of Joy. My name is Joy Mollets, bringing you author interviews every 2 weeks at this hour. And today I'm very pleased to welcome Julie Gleason and Sherry Platt Berman to the studios of KWMR. With a combined experience of over 45 years in the human development and career counseling fields, Julie Gleason and Sherry Platt Berman co-founded the Career Wisdom Institute in July of 2010. When they realized they were both taking an inside-out approach to their work. Both of these women reside in the Bay Area, and in addition to their professional successes and Career Wisdom Institute, they are both active leaders in several different community and philanthropic organizations. And I want to welcome both of you to KWMR. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Thank you.
First of all, why don't you start by telling us what you mean when you say inside out? It's in the title of your book, and in the introduction I just read, you say you realized you were both taking an inside out approach. What does that mean?
Well, that means that decisions about life and how we want to live life comes from within us and then is lived out in the world. And we also realized, I've been doing career counseling for over 20 years, and so I realized that most career planning models have people planning which jobs they're going to be fitting themselves into, and instead of really taking the time to reflect on who they are and what they want and what their skills are and what their design is and where their heart lies, and then building a career from that.
And Julie, perhaps you can say, so is this approach different from the way many career counselors approach advising people?
Yes, the inside-out approach in many different places. Is different in the following way. Mostly we're trying to control our circumstances, trying to control our employers, trying to control the people around us, trying to control our relationships. And mostly you'll notice that doesn't work. You just get more and more frustrated. When you find out who you are internally and what you can't help doing and kind of the Sherry-ness that comes into a room with Sherry or the Joy-ness that comes into the room with Joy or the Julie-ness that comes into the room with Julie and start to respect and honor that and work from there, you have a completely different way of presenting yourself to an employer or inventing a business.
That is very interesting. At the beginning of your book, you talk about how the career patterns and career beliefs of our parents and even our grandparents still affect us very profoundly and how they may not really serve us. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, they served our grandparents and our ancestors, so I don't want to take anything away from that. Our generation comes from, most of us come from ancestors who actually had a fair amount of trauma. And so the idea of inside out did not occur to them. They were too busy making a living and trying to figure out where the next dime was going to come from. But they have given us a legacy where we actually can be more reflective. However, our brains, our neurology, our thinking, even our DNA is influenced by our ancestors and their trauma or ancestors and their thinking. And so a lot of our thinking about work is unconscious. And so we unconsciously, for example, the thought of if I don't make money, I'm going to live under a bridge. Right?
Yeah.
So I hear that all the time. I even hear that from young people. Mm-hmm. And usually I can trace that back to a Depression-era grandparent or great-grandparent. And that is not going to happen. That's not even something that's practical that anyone is going to live under a bridge, especially the clients that we see. And so it's interesting that that's a picture or an image that comes up for people.
Yes.
And that's usually an ancestral image because that was true for their ancestors and that was true for their relatives.
And the thing about neurology is it's invisible to the naked eye and to our thinking. And so thinking was designed to be believable. And the problem is if we have a thought like, if I don't get the high enough paid job, I'm going to live under a bridge, it seems real. It doesn't occur to us like it's thought. So one of the places that we start with all of our work is how do you begin to catch your own thinking so that you know whether you want to believe it or not. It gives you a choice about believing that thought or not. That is the foundation of where we start, and it makes us completely different from all the other models.
Well, it also strikes me that the world of work is very different from what it was when our parents and grandparents were working. I mean, I recently interviewed Roz Chast about her book of cartoons about her graphic memoir about her parent, her elderly parents dying. And one of the things she said is her parents believed that every building had a super, mm-hmm. that you lived in a building that had a super, and you went to work at a job until you retired and got a pension from that job.
Sorry.
And those things are just not true anymore.
Well, the irony is that they weren't true for our great-grandparents, right? So that was true for our parents, because our thinking that we're supposed to have one job or fit into one box for life really comes with the Industrial Revolution. But prior to the Industrial Revolution, we did work on a day-to-day basis. We often had trades. You might have been a blacksmith or a farmer, but this idea that you go to a place where you receive a paycheck and address an assembly line of sorts is actually a fairly new thought, which we believe is why that thinking is not holding up, because in the long run, it doesn't really fit the life that anybody wants to live, that kind of structure. People seek freedom, people seek independence, people seek creativity, and so that model actually, I'm not sure it really worked for anyone, but it worked.
I'm curious, too, on that point. You say in your book that everyone these days should be entrepreneurial. I may be misquoting mm-hmm. you slightly, but mm-hmm. I think that's the gist of it. Mm-hmm. For many people, they have no desire to be entrepreneurial or no skills in that regard. So what do you mean when you say everyone has to think in an entrepreneurial fashion?
Well, again, we have to be careful of what we think entrepreneurial means. So what we mean by entrepreneurial, let's just define it for us so that we're clear about what we're talking about, is we mean, do you understand what you were put on this earth to serve, what lights you up the most to do in life? And I don't mean do like a job. I mean do like the work that throughout your whole life, when you're doing more of this, you're radiating and you're passionate, and when you're doing less of it, you're more and more frustrated and you're more tired. When you're entrepreneurial, you are starting with that thing that you're focusing on, that thing that you're serving, and you're working from there, knowing that you'll do your best work if you're doing that thing. So we have a client I met with a couple of months ago who got a job after working with us, and she's very happy in her job, and now she's going to have another baby. And so she met with me to find out if she needed to find a new job that paid her more, because she found out that there were many people in her same job that weren't making that were making more than she was. And when we went all the way through it, she realized that she was working from this place so much that she would be nuts to leave it. Those were her words, not mine. She said, "Why am I even meeting with you?" That was what she said at the end.
Yeah.
So she got back in touch with that entrepreneurial spirit and realized that being close to home, having a boss that gave her flexible hours, having all the autonomy in the world, and making the salary that she was making, which, oh, by the way, covered all of her expenses, was sufficient. That's an entrepreneurial model, but we aren't satisfied with that because we hear that the person next door is making more money.
Also, entrepreneurial thinking is knowing that you aren't actually relying on a job to make money.
Correct.
So anytime we rely on a job or a company or someone else to make money, we actually lose our security. So people come to us and say, what do I want? I want job security, so I want a job. Then I always tell them, then the last thing in the world you should be looking for is a job. Because anytime we rely on someone else to give us something, you lose your sense of security. So when you have an entrepreneurial mentality, it means that you're doing this job with the understanding that the job itself will probably fade at some point. Any healthy company is going to grow and change and shift, and jobs are going to grow and change and shift. And if they don't, the company decompensates, and the people within the company also in their own way decompensate and starve from lack of creativity. So an entrepreneurial mindset is knowing that you are capable of understanding yourself so well that you can take care of yourself at any time, and that you're not actually reliant on a job.
In case you're just joining us, my guests today are Julie Gleason and Sherry Platt Berman. They are career counselors, and their book is called Inside Job, 8 Secrets to Loving Your Work and Thriving. And you're tuned to KWMR, 90.5 in Point Reyes, 89.9 in Bolinas, 92.3 in San Geronimo Valley, and streaming live at kwmr.org. My name is Joy Mollets. And part of what you're saying about how you have to create your own security, you follow that up in the book with talking about how promotions actually come from your own self.
Mm-hmm.
What does that
mean?
Are
you talking about job promotions or?
I'm just quoting from the book. At some point you say promotions come from within. And I assume that means that when you inside realize that you're ready for something more, mm-hmm. you find a way to go out and find it.
Yeah, Julie always says that it's not possible to be bored. So it's when oftentimes when we get to a place in our own job and when we find ourselves bored, that it really requires some personal reflection about why. Like what has happened, to honor that, to honor the feeling of a sense of boredom, and then to ask yourself, what is the next thing? What is the next self-promotion, right? What is the way in which you want to grow next?
Yeah. So let me pose a hard case. Suppose somebody, like me, for example, you start by talking about what you love to do, right? Is that a starting point?
No.
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got it wrong. So what
well,
is the
that, I think
point?
That's probably more mainstream career counseling or career coaching.
Okay.
And that's why it doesn't work. So why don't you go ahead and take
well,
this, Julie?
The place that we start, again, is with your thinking. And so we would teach you our model. And our model is that we want you to know what you're thinking has to do with the experience you're having in life, number one. And what is the experience you want to have in life? This is a question that very few people actually ask, is when I go to work, how do I want to experience my work? What do I want my work to feel like? You're in a studio. You're not with other people other than the people you're interviewing. That might make claustrophobic people crazy. That's not an experience mm-hmm. they would want. We would want you to start to investigate, and we have a whole process that we do with that. Also, there are parameters. How far from work do you want to be? How far do you want to drive? Do you have children, so you have to be home at a particular hour?
How much money do you need to make?
Do you need benefits? Is it okay if you have a spouse that's providing benefits? Those are all parameters. There's also a foundation of what are you designed for? So I'm a twin, and my twin sister and I are not identical, but we are 4 minutes apart and raised by the same family in the same house and no divorces in the family. So one would think we were working on the same thing. We are not. She's designed for one thing, and I'm designed for another thing. And when we're clear about that, that difference is a very big positive in our family. Same with you. We would want to know, what did you get born for? What is the thing you can't help but have your eye on and be passionate about?
Well, when you say what is the thing that you can't help but do, isn't that the same thing that you would say that you love doing?
Not necessarily, because it's disrespected. It comes so easily for us. So, for instance, you have a lovely voice, and you have a way of connecting with people that you're using in your work.
Right.
But I don't know that you know that that's probably part of your design.
Because people take for granted what they're
exactly
good at.
That's exactly right. Because we think everybody's good at it if we are.
Yeah.
And we don't really notice that the thing we're good at, we're actually the best at. And you don't have to brag about that. You just have to notice and respect it and start bringing that. Whenever you don't know what to bring, you bring that. And everything starts to work out in a different way.
So your design is you literally come in with this. So it's, I mean, the best example is a litter of puppies. Right. So you have 5 puppies and they're just born and they come from the same parents, but each puppy is completely different. Each puppy has a unique design. And so each human being is like that too. Unfortunately, that the very essence of who we are is often negated at a very young age. And that can be negated for lots of reasons. It can be negated because the family environment doesn't encourage growth. It could be, you know, statements like, it's nice that you're creative, dear, but you'll never get a job doing that. Music's lovely, but you'll never work. Or it's you're naturally good with people, but people will screw you every time, right? So,
or even that you're really, really good at English, so don't study that anymore. Study math, which is just what you're struggling at.
Yeah, a student really taught us that the thing that he was best at, which was math, yeah, nobody focused on the fact that he was good at math. They all focused on the fact that he wasn't good at English.
Yeah.
So, right, so there's a lot of thinking that covers up our unique design. And so when Julie and I are working with people to uncover their design, often about the third session in or the third day in, whether they do the retreat or private work, they end up looking at their design, and often the response is, that's it, which is really sad.
So, or what am I supposed to do
with that?
What
am I supposed to do with this? Like,
right.
This is easy for me,
right?
Right? And I'm like, well, that's what we start to work on. We start to work on what is easy for you. And they're like, well, but work is supposed to be hard. Work is supposed to be about suffering, right?
Right. So, one of the neurological pathways in our culture is this sort of Lutheran whatever work ethic, Protestant work ethic.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Not necessarily true.
So it sort of sounds like what you're saying is you come into the world with a certain shape and form.
Gift.
And gift.
A gift.
Mm-hmm. Set of gifts. And you're looking for work that, like, I'm Joy, I'm looking for joy-shaped work.
Yes. That's very well said.
Okay.
Very well said.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm glad we're recording it. We'll probably use that.
Yeah, we probably will. We're going to steal that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
So once you know your design or begin to have a flavor of it, right, because we can spend a lifetime trying to understand that piece, but once you understand the flavor and you start to honor it, then the second question is, okay, so now what is the experience I want to have? So, you know, I also was a radio disc jockey for many years, and in my 20s, and I did not want to sit in a booth all day for the rest of my life talking to people I can't see. People get locked up for doing things like that, right? Talking to people they can't see. I wanted a different experience. I wanted to be more collaborative. I wanted to be out in the world. And so I searched for opportunities that would give me that kind of an experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So use and honoring this piece of myself at the same time, right?
One of the things we talked about when we were off the air is, and it's covered somewhat in your book too, is the idea that your ideas about work are formed when you're 12 or 14 years old.
Our ideas about work are formed when we're much younger. Right, because basic personality development is that when we're young, we think our parents are God. And so, and they are to a large extent for many years. In fact, you know, we don't have object permanence until age two. We think when our parents leave the room that God has left permanently. So we don't have a separate sense of ourselves. And so whatever is going on around us, we believe to be the truth. And we also believe that we are a part of it. So if there's a lot of stress in the family, we believe we are stressed. If there's a lot of happiness in the family, we experience that too. So early thoughts about what work is, how parents come home and talk about their work, how they feel about the story that children make up in their minds about where mommy and daddy go every day, those actually form neural pathways in the brain and are very real, and they actually run the show. It's why we keep picking the jobs that we don't like, and we mysteriously keep finding the same employer over and over again.
What about people who perhaps their mother or father did not work and their other parent worked, but they never heard about what that parent did? They really didn't know. It was kind of a mystery.
Oh, yeah.
That happened in my family. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and my dad had a job with Standard Oil for 35 years. And I'm telling you, we picked up moods all the time. So my mom had a mood about being a stay-at-home mom, which for the most part was pretty good and occasionally wasn't. And my dad had a mood about being at work, which for the most part was good and occasionally wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of communication, I like to say when I'm working with clients that only 10% of communication has to do with our lips and our ears, that the rest of it is by energetic exchange. Mm-hmm. This is why animals are so interesting to people, is because you can't talk, really. You have to understand them in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
That's true with humans, too. When we walk into a room, we know which human beings we want to sidle up to and which ones we want to stay away from, and it isn't about how they necessarily look.
Or what they say.
Or what they say. That's exactly right. So we are picking up things from our families, even if they're not being communicated, and doing it with a child's brain. You know, the young brain doesn't really fully mature, doesn't get that executive function part until we're in our middle to late 20s. Mm-hmm. And so the young brain is making assumptions about everything that is being, they're being flooded with communications. And nobody stops to actually ask questions about those assumptions. That's where we start our clients, is having you, instead of having them over your eyeballs where you can't tell that they're running the show, we have you have a little space there. So you might be able to say, oh, that's interesting. I don't know that I really think that about work, but maybe my parents did.
Kids fill in the blanks.
They do.
Right. So
in the most amazing ways.
Yeah. So if we're not talking about work to our children, which you should be if you have children, in a positive light. If you're not talking to your children about work, they fill in the blanks. They also watch television. They also listen to community members. They also listen to the news. They listen to their friends. So it's not like the parents are the sole influencer.
Right. This is KWMR, West Marin Radio, 90.5 in Point Reyes, 89.9 in Bolinas, and 92.3 in San Geronimo Valley. My name is Joy Mollets, and my guests are Julie Gleason and Sherry Platt Berman, authors of Inside Job, 8 Secrets to Loving Your Work and Thriving. How would you describe your clients? I gather from this book that a large majority of your clients are not kids right out of college trying to pick a career, but are instead people in the middle of their careers who are dissatisfied and wanting something different or something more. Is that right?
That's true. We do work with all ages of people, but our what we call our target market is really people in their mid-40s to mid-60s, with the sweet spot seeming to be 44 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is, but that's the majority of people that come in, between 44 and 45. Men come in, probably a third to two-thirds women. And really what they're interested in is, how do they have more meaning in life, or how do they have more autonomy in life, or how do they explain the gap in their resume, in women's cases, where they've been raising children and they have this big gap in their resumes and they don't know how to sort of get from having been a working parent to now not working and then having to restart again. So people that were probably executives or well-educated and are looking for what's next. But the meaning thing, you know, Sherry talks about it, and I'll let you talk about the hormonal issue about this, too, because there's a...
Yeah, but that. I also want to say that, so healthy career development starts right around the age of 12 to 14, between the ages of 12 and 14. So anybody as a teenager knows, or probably is beginning to witness, their children wondering what they're going to do with their lives. So in healthy development, that's what happens. When our development is inhibited by trauma, sexual abuse,
alcoholism,
right, accident, loss of a parent, bullying. Mm. For LGBT people, being afraid to be out, anything like that can inhibit career growth, and so people just do what they do to get by. But right around 44 and 45, we sort of have, you know, people call it a midlife crisis, we call it a midlife awakening. People are at a place where they can actually begin to reflect and are hormonally, you know, Gail Sheehy, her guess is that in women at that age, our estrogen levels are dropping and our testosterone levels are increasing, and men are actually experiencing the opposite. And so there's a lot of personal reflection right around that time. So it's almost like having another teenager.
There's inherent change going on within us.
Yes. And
physiological as well as
psychological, right.
Exactly.
And so I think midlife crises aren't really crises. They're just midlife waking up. And, you know, we're living until 85, 95. So it's 45. You have another 40 years of productivity. And so what do you want? You want to keep doing it the way you've been doing it, or do you want to do it differently and have a different life?
So for many of us who are in our late, in our mid-40s or quite a bit older, there is a fear that we're too old, that there's no way we're going to be able to reshape ourselves and actually find paid work.
Right, that's a thought.
Right. That's one of those neural pathways. And it turns out there's a new term called returnships that you can look up on Google. Mm-hmm. And many employers are looking for are people who were trustworthy employees and are now coming back into the marketplace, and they actually prefer those kind of employees. So, yes, there are people who are not interested in the population that we're talking about. That's going to always be true. It's always going to be true that that there are certain groups of people that don't get hired as much as other groups of people. You just don't, you find that out and you move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is, our wisdom ages are, the people of us, those of us in the wisdom years, are more and more and more in demand because our brains are formed, our families are done, we have an ability to focus in a way that young people don't focus.
And I would think for those of us who have gone through a process like what you're describing, the employer knows that you are sincere and that
Absolutely.
You have you figured out your true mm-hmm. role in
yes.
life.
One of the biggest things about what's happening in the job market right now is that if an employer opens up a job anywhere online, they get anywhere from 100 to 1,000 resumes, mm-hmm. most of which are not anywhere near being dead on to employable in that. Yeah, so we teach you how do you talk about yourself so that when somebody reads that mm-hmm. piece of paper or listens to your first sentences out of your mouth, mm-hmm. they go, oh my gosh, that person really is a good fit for us.
Mm-hmm. And if anybody's listening right now who is doing a job search by looking online on Craigslist or Idealist or Indeed. It's an extraordinarily frustrating situation.
And depressing.
Mm-hmm. And that is not the way people find. In fact, I think even Monster.com posted a statistic that only 1% of all people who look on Monster.com actually get jobs from there. So we're not saying don't do it. We're just saying if it's the majority of your job search is looking online for opportunity, that is not the way to look.
Well, let's follow that up then.
Sure.
This book doesn't really talk about the actual getting the job once you've figured out your plan.
Right.
If that's not the way that people find jobs by looking online, what are the ways that people find jobs?
Well, there's a whole universe of jobs called the hidden job market. And the truth is that about 85% of all new jobs are being formed by small businesses. And small businesses can be anywhere between zero to, I think the number changes, like 300 people, 350 people.
Yeah, or even up to 500 is considered a small business.
Yeah. So that is where most of the jobs are taking place. And small business owners are often overwhelmed and may not even have the proper HR recruiting structure in-house to do a good candidate search on their behalf. So when they put jobs online and are inundated, they freeze. We actually have another division of CWI called Hiring Concierge, where we actually help small business owners with their recruiting process because it's so overwhelming.
Does that cross over with the clients that you have sometimes?
It's beginning to, yeah.
Yeah, it is. And this way, clients who come to us can also get help finding employment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You asked us earlier about the age groups. I want to say that, 45 is our sweet spot, but we also work really well with college students or people who make a choice to not go to college and want to take a different route, a different professional. We don't have an agenda for. In fact, we are the opposite of the agenda. And we often really annoy local parents in our area because when they ask us, do our children have to have college degrees and do our, what should our children be studying, the answer is always, what do they want to do? And that's extraordinarily frustrating. And
It's hard
for a parent to hear, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My name is Joy Mollets. I'm speaking with Sherry Platt Berman. She was the one just speaking. And Julie Gleason. They are career counselors, and their book is called Inside Job, 8 Secrets to Loving Your Work and Thriving. One thing I've been curious about, when you research career counseling, you often end up with life coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, what is the difference between a life coach and a career counselor? And what are people looking for if they hire one? And what should people be looking for if they hire the other?
Do we have another hour conversation on this one? So first, let's talk about the term career counselor, right? So in order to call yourself a career counselor, and so Julie's actually a career consultant.
Right.
To call yourself a career counselor, you have to have a master's degree in counseling or a master's degree in career counseling. And the reason why that's so important is because very rarely are people there just about the work, right? So work is life, life is work. And when there's a challenge in one end of our lives, like work, it usually is because there are challenges on many ends of our life. So,
or the other challenges in your life make you aware of the fact that your work is not fulfilling.
Yeah, exactly. It's all connected.
It's all holographic.
It's all holographic.
Right.
Exactly. So that's why career counselors have counseling backgrounds. Career coaches, I think it depends on the career coach, but often they don't have the same training or the same background in that. Now, what should they look for? I think the thing that makes Career Wisdom Institute and makes us so good is that we not only help people figure out what they want to do, but then how to go get it. And many career counselors and many life coaches don't know both parts.
Right.
They help with one part, but then it's... What's important is once you actually know what you want to do and you understand your design and the experience that you want to have and the parameters of your life, how do you talk about that to an employer? How do you express yourself? What is your elevator pitch? How does your resume reflect that? How do you create a hidden job search job strategy so that you're not competing with the thousands of people out there who are unemployed? So it's good career counseling is divided up into what do I want, and then how do I go get it?
Right.
So I think that's a big differentiation. And I would encourage people to really research. We give a free one-hour session to anybody who is interested because we think it's important that people understand that career counseling is actually a collaborative effort. So it's not like therapy. Therapy is often we sit in the office and there's some collaboration. This is like people say, does this work? And our answer is, if you do what we tell you to do, it works.
Right.
So life coaches, again, I don't know if there's any, there's no national certification yet for life coaching. I would just encourage people to research who they're talking to and what their background is. And,
right. And experience is really, really, really important in both those categories. So I can say it drives me crazy to have somebody who's in their mid-20s calling themselves a career coach and working with somebody in their 50s.
I've seen some of those people online, and I'm like, what is that person going to tell
me? Now, they may
me?
Be designed for that and very good at it, but I recommend that you ask lots of questions and talk to people that they've worked with, et cetera.
Right.
I always tell college students or anybody who is on a college campus, never get career advice from a tenured professor.
Right.
Because they haven't been in the world of work. So you really want to research... I've been a recruiter, I've been a hiring manager, I've been in the personnel. I call myself like an employment geek. For some reason, work is my thing.
Right.
I just enjoy it. So that I encourage anybody, and we work with people via Skype and also Fuse, so video conferencing, with people all over the country around this.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing I found interesting on this in this area that we're discussing is that you point out that many career counselors use standardized testing to assess what people want. And I've often thought about those tests and how you sort of, it's so easy to answer the way you want to be or the way you think you should be. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem, I gather.
It's even worse than that. So even if you filter out for that and you promise yourself you're going to be good about that, this invisible neurological thinking that goes on is answering the questions for you. So you get put back into the box you're trying to leave very, very many times. So they're fun. The testing is fun. And sometimes you sort of have an insight about something. But what you're actually testing is the level of thinking you have, not who you are. Mm-hmm. And what we want to do is, that's why we do this one-day program on a sort of monthly or every six-week basis, is to teach people about their thinking so that they can then actually do a job search and come out someplace that's different from where they started.
Mm-hmm. But your approach requires people to answer questions, mm-hmm. right,
yes.
about
mm-hmm.
themselves. And mm-hmm. that can be very difficult. I mean, I looked mm-hmm. at some of the questions mm-hmm. in your book. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a quick answer. I mean,
good.
I knew where I would go in the bookstore. I did know that.
Right.
Although my immediate response to that was, well, how am I ever going to get a job because I want to read novels? But I also, the other questions were very, very difficult to answer.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is it really hard for people to go through this?
It is and it isn't. So part of what we do is make it safe enough and have enough reflective time so that people can actually take their best shot at the questions. The question that you're speaking about is, when we're investigating your design, we ask you things like, when you go into a bookstore, what section do you head for first? Or when you're in a doctor's office, what magazine articles can you not help but stealing the magazine so you can read?
What is the thing that you do that you can't help but do? What are the things that you notice? I mean, it's self-reflection questions.
Yes. The thing that Sherry and I are really, really good at, brilliant at probably, and probably designed for, is to mentor people to reflect back to our clients who they are. So we take a neutral stance. We are not judgmental about who you end up being, but we're very good at ferreting out the theme that's running through the answers to your questions. So it doesn't really matter what the answers are. There will be a theme, and as we point out the theme, you'll start to say, oh, you're right. That's always been of interest to me.
And is there always paid work that will go with that theme?
Yes, and many, many different kinds of paid work that goes with that theme. So you're not limited to just being a CPA or just being a lawyer or just being a butcher, whatever it is you are. What you find out is what you like about being a CPA and what you like about being a lawyer. In fact, my CPA is also a Qigong master. Now, try and get those two to go together.
Right.
But when you look at her design, it makes perfect sense.
It's understanding yourself from this place is what will keep you sustainably employed. So what happens is that we identify with, you go to a party and people say, what do you do? And you say, I'm a lawyer, I'm a radio disc jockey. And when you're not employed, people don't know how to answer that question. In fact, one of the worst things is to be unemployed at a party where people say, so what do you do? And you're like, nothing.
I look for work.
I look for work, right. So when you understand yourself from design and you introduce yourself from that, so you're not interested, job titles will come and go, right? So we're actually trying to teach people to back up and not identify themselves from their job title, but to identify themselves from their unique design. It gets much more interesting and much more opportunity shows up. So you just said a minute ago that you enjoy reading books. Is that what you said?
Novels.
Yeah. Okay, so my guess is that you're working on something else. Like, is there a type of novel that you enjoy reading?
Very well written. I don't like sort of mid-list fiction. I like, you know, great literature.
Have you been like that since you were a kid?
Yes.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting to, is there a type of literature that you?
I like historical fiction. I like fiction that involves, that features women as main characters, fiction that has characters changing.
So it's a character.
I'm not big on plot. It's character.
Character development.
Character
theme. Yeah. So you're interested in people's stories.
Yes.
Of course, you're in radio.
And look what you're doing,
people,
right?
Makes sense. And there's lots of places where being interested in stories and people's stories and women's stories could be an employable thing.
I see.
That's the thing I love the most about being a career counselor, by the way, is I get to listen to people's stories all day.
Oh, it must be fascinating.
It is. It never gets old. It's always fascinating. Everybody's interesting.
So going back to what you said about how hard it is when you're unemployed to answer the question, what do you do? Mm-hmm. What do you say?
I think everybody says something different. That's what we
teach
people to do.
Give me an example of what
I'm always working on two things. I'm always working on helping people figure out the truth of who they are and then living it. So if I was at a party and I was completely unemployed and somebody said, what do? I say, you know, I am always working on people finding the truth about who they are and how to live that truth out in the world. And Julie has a different thing that she says.
What would you say, Julie?
I always say I am fascinated by the difference between people. And I'm always interested in having them understand what makes them different and learning how to honor and respect that.
We have the whole hospitality thing, too.
I do. And one of the ways I do that is to make sure that people are comfortable in their own skin, comfortable in our workshop space, comfortable in my home, comfortable wherever they are. That's a way of honoring the difference. We have this thing that we say to all of our clients, and it always shocks them, which is, what if there was nothing wrong with you? How would you live your life?
And what if suffering wasn't an option?
How would you live your life? Right.
So, Joy, you right now, even just in this 30-second conversation, we could say at a party, if you were, you know, not introducing it, made a commitment to not introduce yourself from your job title, people might say to you, so what do you do? And you say, well, I am perpetually fascinated in people's stories.
Yeah.
And what will happen is other people will get really interested in that because that's interesting, right? And they'll say to you, well, how do you do that? And you say, oh, I do it in lots of ways. I do it. I have my own talk show, and I do it as an attorney, and I do it as a, and you would name two or three. And we work with people on what to say, on how to say it. But that's a very different way.
It's interesting that you say you work with people on what to say because there is an element of a job search or career change where we're so aware of how we're going to present ourselves to the world because this is our identity that we're so used to and our friends and our family are used to. And if we're going to turn it upside down, how do we present ourselves?
Well, and the people that come to us, it's already turned upside down. And so they have this fractured, like they don't know how to present. They don't know who to present. They don't know how to present. And so what we do is we put them back in their own skin in the way that they're actually designed for and then teach them how to begin to understand themselves that way so that any situation they have something to say about that based on this one design.
So I'm curious, and let me just say, if you're just joining us, my name is Joy Mollets. This is Waves of Joy on KWMR. I'm speaking with Julie Gleason and Sherry Platt Berman. They are career counselors, and their book is called Inside Job, 8 Secrets to Loving Your Work and Thriving. I'm curious, what would be a hard case for you? Like someone walks into your office and you realize, oh, wow, this is going to be challenging. Mm-hmm. What presents that picture for you?
We've had a few of those. Mainly it's that people are not interested or curious about their thinking. If they think they already know and they just need a little support to fluff their resume or to help with the calls, we're probably not the right place. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's clear to both parties that it's just not a good fit, and so we'll send them to a more traditional place.
Yeah. I think another answer for that is that when people – so what we do is we teach people how to have different thinking and how to live with different stories. And some people really like their stories.
Right.
Some people really like the story about how they're suffering. Some people love being the victim. Some people really say they want change but really aren't willing to do anything about it. Our work is not easy. Right? And you just said those questions are hard. It's supposed to be hard.
Yeah.
But so that's the answer about who's challenging it. And we screen out those people, and they screen themselves out because they realize they don't want to do the work. We will meet with people individually to do things like resumes and et cetera. But people who are really in a career transition, who really want to, like college students, not so interested in this. Some are, but most aren't. Young age people.
They're not supposed to be, by the way.
Yeah.
They're in the stage of life where they should be experimenting and not
learning.
And learning,
yeah,
right.
It's just so, yeah, that's anybody between the ages of 17 and 30, those are career exploration times. And so expecting a 17-year-old to know what they're going to do for the rest of their lives is nuts.
And it applies pressure that's not good for them.
Right. And their brains aren't even fully developed until 26. So anyway, so the point is that those are people who love their story of suffering so much that they actually don't want to change should not come work with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anybody else shifts.
But if you think that suffering is required for you to actually be well employed, we're not a good place to work either.
Mm-mm.
Because we really believe that when you go to work, your job is to come home in better shape than when you went there.
So
it should nourish you.
It should nourish you. It should inspire you. It should give you more energy rather than take energy.
One of our mottos is that work is healing, and we heal through our work.
What percentage of working people do you think actually have jobs that do that for them?
The studies are that it's no more than 30%. And
30%.
I think that's high. I think it's probably more like 10 or 15.
And is it possible that we can all find that? Because it seems to me there are a lot of jobs that have to be done, and there are a lot of people that need a job and are perhaps not highly skilled or educated. So you got people who need to be plumbers, or they need to do factory work.
And there are people whose designs have them love plumbing or factory work. Many of the people we work with end up staying exactly where they are in their jobs. I've got a woman I've been working with for almost 8 years who is a very, very large corporation, and she was so stressed when we started, and she went through all of our programs, and she realized that by making a slight tweak in how she perceived her work and going to a different group within the company, she could be a much happier woman. And she's now a director of whatever she's a director of, and she's on this trajectory to retire, and she's really happy. And so the thing we assume, I mean, we have job prejudice. That's one of the terms that Sherry made up, is we have job prejudice. Like, nobody could really love being a plumber. I know a plumber who's, he's nuts, but he loves plumbing, and he's like one of the best. You can't even get hold of him. He's so in demand because he is inventing solutions to plumbing issues all the time. Mm-hmm. He's designed to be a plumber.
Joy, have you ever met someone or had a friend who kept dating the same schmuck over and over and over again?
Right? Sure.
So the reason, even though she said this time it's going to be different, this time it's going to be different, right? So the reason why they keep choosing the same person over and over again is because they've never stopped to investigate their thinking.
Right.
Right. The early, the unconscious thinking that has people continue to choose poor partners. So why I bring that up is sometimes it's not the job.
Right.
It's the thinking about the job. So not everybody who comes to us, like Julie just said, leaves their jobs. But when you get a different perspective about how to think about your work, then lots of opportunity opens up. And more possibilities emerge, even in the job you're currently in.
Yeah.
And there may be many different ways. The County of Marin hired us to come in and work with employees so that they start to take advantage of different opportunities that exist within the county.
Mm-hmm.
And we started with thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing I found really interesting in your book was the idea that career or work does not move in a linear fashion, but moves in a cyclical fashion, almost like the seasons. And you lay out sort of the seasons of work. And I found it really reassuring in a way that because we all know that winter, even though it's cold and dark, is necessary before you get to spring. And I wondered if you could say a few words in particular about that cycle, and in particular winter, and how it's a time of reflection and how important that is.
Well, it goes back to the thing that we said about that our clients come to us and often think there's something wrong with them. And where that comes from is that in a linear model of life, you know, you're born and
it's a ladder, right?
Yeah, you go to kindergarten and then you get you graduate and then you go to college, and whatever you do, you get a job and you get more, you climb the ladder and then you retire and then you do traveling and then you die. The problem is, if you don't get a degree, you feel like you've done something wrong. Or if you have to stay home and take care of a parent, you feel like something's wrong.
Or you get sick.
Or you get sick, or you don't have children, or you don't get married. Or there's always like, there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with me. That gets embedded in our very being. Mm-hmm. The truth is, and Sherry and I researched this before we published it so that we wouldn't be lying, there's no such thing as a straight line in nature.
Right.
So everything is cyclical. Everything has a cycle to it. So there's always a beginning of things, which is this kind of spring. There's always a time when that beginning comes to fruition, which is sort of like summer. Then there's always a time when that comes to an end, which is like fall. And then there's this period of rest and reflection and renewal that nobody wants to do in the work part, which is where all new ideas come from. It's where germination starts, where incubation starts. And it is the place that most of our clients are in when they come to us, and they're very distressed for two reasons. One is they're enjoying the heck out of being as relaxed as they are, but they know they need to go back to work, and so they're fighting with, I don't ever want to feel like that again at my work. I want to feel like this, and how do I get work that continues me feeling like this? We can answer that question. The dark place, the hallway, the in-between place is necessary to go through. And if you avoid that, you end up jumping back into the thing that you're trying to escape. It's more like the flat tire effect. Shh-clunk, shh-clunk.
Instead of a circle.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what you want is to have permission to be in the place that you're at. And to know that no matter how good something is, it's going to evolve. It's going to go through that cycle. Some say it's a 7-year cycle. Some say it's a 3-year cycle. Whatever the cycle is, it's constantly moving up. So it's not a cycle that has you either flat or going down. It's an upward trajectory. But it is always something coming into fruition, something coming apart. Then.
Well, and it's the coming apart that's interesting, too. You talk about how there is some grieving involved in
yes.
making change
mm-hmm.
because you're
yes.
letting go of something.
If you don't let go of something, nothing new can come in. It's like the Tibetan Buddhist monk pouring tea into the cup and
they keep just, pouring and pouring and
yes,
pouring.
Yes, and there's no more room to fill it. Yeah, it's just like that. You have to allow things to come apart to be able to hear how to have it come back together.
Well, and this leads me to my other question about that, which is, you talk about mood in the book and mm-hmm. how it affects your approach toward work or changing career. And I think for many people who are looking for work or considering making a big change, it's scary and it's full of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very hard to be confident and positive and convince people that you are the person for their job opening, when you're in that frame of mind. And you have some ideas about how to approach that.
Well, there are three, we teach that there are three primary moods that we fluctuate through at any time. And when we understand that moods are temporary, then we can start to give ourselves a break. So sometimes, the lowest mood is the victim mood. This is the mood where people say things like, there are no jobs, no one will hire me because I'm too old, too ugly, too fat. Everybody else gets a job but me. The economy sucks, and so there's no opportunity. That's all the victim box, right? Then there's the hyper-responsible box, or mood, I should say. And the hyper-responsible mood is more like, I'm going to send 25 resumes out, and I'm going to contact 100 people, and or I'm going to work and 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 work. When we're in that mood, and Julie likes to say that's the San Francisco Bay Area mood, it's very hard to have a sense of accomplishment, and that's also where we tend to do a lot of multitasking. Multitasking is actually not possible. There's a lot of neurology that backs that up, and doesn't really accomplish a lot. So not only do we not accomplish fully well, but we also don't feel accomplished. And then the third mood is the grace mood, the sense of freedom and flow. Grace does not mean that we're always in the Zen-like condition. It means that grace is that we're very present with what is. Anytime we're a victim, we're stuck in the past. Anytime we're in hyper-responsible mode, we're in the future. And when we're in our grace box or the grace mood, we tend to be in present time dealing with what is. So most people walk into job interviews in the victim box.
Like, they're not going to like me.
Well, they're not going to like me. They have all the interviewer has all the control.
Please, sir, may I have a job?
Right. It's a scene from Oliver, right? So it's not a great mood to be in, and employers can smell fear like that a mile away.
Right.
And the truth is, I always tell people that, which often helps them stay more in a grace place, is to think in terms of every job as a party, that's every job interview as a party being thrown on your behalf.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's an opportunity. There's so many ways to look at it, right? I love interviewing. You get to go in and meet new people and learn about a company.
Something. So it's about being curious.
It's about, right. So when we are curious, you cannot help but be in the grace and freedom box.
That's really encouraging.
Yeah. If it's authentic curiosity, you have to make sure it's not just feigned. Because mostly when we're in the mood of being a victim or overwhelmed and hyper-responsible, we are not interested in anything. We're not curious about anything. We just want it to stop and go away.
Well, so here's just neurological research.
Yeah.
Is that when we suffer and when we're really scared, the brain actually cannot function at its optimal. So this whole concept that we have to suffer to make money actually works against us.
Sure.
It's actually the opposite of truth, is that when we suffer, we actually can't make money.
Sure. I understand that. Yeah. I really get that. Mm-hmm. So, Julie Gleason and Sherry Platt Berman, tell people where they can find out more about you, where they can get your book, etc.
Well, our website is www.careerwisdominstitute.com. Our book is available at Amazon.com. Sometimes you can get it used on there, and always new. And there's a digital form of it as well for the Kindle. And you can always call us at 925-408-8422 or
925-212-7805.
Right.
Okay.
And that phone number is online.
Well, I really enjoyed the book. I think it's full of interesting ideas, and I've really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you so much for making the trek.
Thank you, Joy.
Really enjoyed it. Sherry Platt Berman and Julie Gleason, authors of Inside Job, 8 Secrets to Loving Your Work and Thriving. You're tuned to KWMR. Thanks for listening.